This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. The United Nations Refugee Agency is appealing to Sudan's neighbors to keep their borders open to people fleeing the fighting that erupted on April 15th. Since fighting between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces erupted, thousands of Sudanese have been forced to leave their homes in fear of their lives. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he's working very closely with the United Nations on the crisis in Sudan.
We believe that the best way to have an enduring capability to help people leave Sudan, if that's what they so choose, is overland. And we are working to establish a process that would enable people to move overland to a place where they can more easily exit the country, in all likelihood Port Sudan. So that's under very active development.
Despite an extension of the latest ceasefire between the warring parties, fighting was reported in Khartoum and the western Darfur region on Thursday. Before fighting erupted 2 weeks ago, one in three Sudanese, more than 15 million people overall, needed humanitarian assistance. The UN is struggling to finance its aid operation in Sudan. A humanitarian appeal for 2023 this year for $1.7 billion has received only $200 million. Russia said Thursday it's denying an upcoming council visit to detain U.S. journalist Evan Gershkovich in retaliation for the American refusal to issue visas to several Russian journalists. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov complained last weekend that the United States had denied visas to Russian journalists set to travel with him to the U.N. headquarters in New York. Gershkovich, a Wall Street reporter, was arrested last month while on a reporting assignment. Russia contends he was caught red-handed spying on a Russian military installation. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. The Pentagon continues facing questions over the history of the Massachusetts Air National Guardsman held in a classified document leak probe. We get more from the AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
Federal prosecutors say Jack Teixeira kept an arsenal of guns, said on social media he wanted to kill a ton of people, and was suspended in high school when a classmate overheard him discussing weapons and racial threats. So did the Pentagon mess up by letting Teixeira enlist, let alone get a high security clearance?
I think it's important to allow this investigation to look at the totality of this case.
Brigadier General Pat Ryder says while that played out,
the vast majority of people who are awarded security clearances come to work every day and do the right thing. And this investigation will tell us what happened and where this individual did the wrong thing.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
AP correspondent Jackie Gwynn reporting that prosecutors had wanted to question former Vice President Mike Pence about conversations and possible planning that took place before the deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol back on 2021.
An inside source tells the Associated Press the former vice president did testify before the grand jury investigating efforts by former President Trump and his allies to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Mike Pence may provide prosecutors with a first-person account about certain conversations and actions in the weeks leading up to the deadly attack on the Capitol in 2021, which included calls for hanging Pence as a traitor. Pence was supposed to testify earlier this year, but Donald Trump's lawyers had objected, citing executive privilege. But a federal appeals court ruled he could. In his memoir, Pence outlines Trump's pressure campaign, urging him to reject Joe Biden's election victory. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The head of a church in eastern Kenya, Pastor Ezekiel Ombako Dero, has been arrested in relation to mass killings, according to government officials. His case is separate from that of another pastor, Paul McKenzie, accused of deaths of at least 98 people. Authorities say McKenzie encouraged his followers to starve to death to meet God. Mali and its neighbor, Algeria, Thursday said they wished to revive a 2015 peace deal between Bamako and northern Malian rebels that today lies in limbo, raising fears of renewed violence. The pact aimed at easing tensions in the region that exploded into violence in 2012 when ethnic Tuaregs mounted an insurgency against the central government. For more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
We'll be right back. An update on the grand jury investigation into the deadly U.S. Capitol insurrection.
Mike Pence may provide prosecutors with a first-person account about certain conversations and actions in the weeks leading up to the deadly attack on the Capitol in 2021.
Plus, a Russian mercenary group may have a hand in supporting one of Sudan's warring rivals.
Obviously, we don't want to see this conflict expand or broaden, and we certainly wouldn't want to see additional firepower brought to bear that will just continue the violence and continue to escalate the tensions.
And are movie theaters still taking a backseat to living room couches post-pandemic? Today is Friday, April 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. The Biden administration is sanctioning Russia's Federal Security Service and Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps intelligence organization for wrongfully detaining Americans. It's the first rollout of new sanctions authorities established last year by President Joe Biden for use against those unjustly holding Americans captive. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre briefed reporters about it on Thursday.
Today's sanctions afford the administration's additional leverage to support negotiations and impose additional costs on those who are responsible for unjustly holding Americans against their will.
Russia on Thursday said it's denying an upcoming consular visit to detained U.S. journalist Evan Gershkovich in retaliation for the United States' refusal to issue visas to several Russian journalists. Following a phone conversation on Wednesday between Chinese leader Xi Jinping and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, China says it will send a peace envoy to Ukraine and other countries, and that it wants to act as a mediator in Russia's war on Ukraine. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Amid Russian shelling and destruction in eastern Ukraine, China surprised the world Wednesday with this announcement.
The Chinese side will send a special representative of the Chinese government on Eurasian affairs to visit Ukraine and other countries to conduct in-depth communication with all parties for a political settlement of the Ukrainian crisis.
China made several public announcements Wednesday, calling attention to its diplomatic initiative toward Ukraine, saying that Chinese leader Xi Jinping spoke with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Zelensky had been asking to speak with Xi and took to Twitter to welcome the conversation. In Washington, White House National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby welcomed the news of the leaders' conversation, saying it's important for President Xi and PRC officials to avail themselves of the Ukrainian perspective on this illegal and unprovoked invasion by Russia. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said that Moscow sees broad concord with China's approach, but that the main obstacle is what she termed Kyiv's unrealistic demands. She visited Moscow in March. Beijing has refused to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine or demand withdrawal of its troops, instead calling for restraint by all parties and accusing NATO of fomenting the fighting. This leaves most foreign policy experts skeptical that China can play the peacemaker. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Armed fighters have rampaged through a main city in Sudan's war-ravaged region of Darfur, battling each other and looting shops and homes. Thursday's violence came despite the extension of a fragile truce between Sudan's two rival generals. Meanwhile, reports have emerged this week that the Kremlin-linked Wagner Group could be supplying weapons to one of the warring parties in the conflict in Sudan. Solomon has the story.
New reports suggest that the Kremlin-backed mercenaries with the Wagner Group in Sudan may have offered weapons to one of the two rival Sudanese generals. But as violence rages in the country, high-level U.S. officials have expressed concern that the group's involvement will only worsen the situation.
Obviously, we don't want to see this conflict expand or broaden, and we certainly wouldn't want to see additional firepower brought to bear that will just continue the violence and continue to escalate the tensions.
Two generals are fighting for power, General Abdel Fattah Burhan, head of the armed forces, and General Mohamed Hamdan Dogolo or Hemeti, the leader of a paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces. Hemeti traveled to Russia last year and has sought to win support from Wagner.
Hemeti and his Rapid Support Forces are largely in control of the major gold mining regions in Sudan and have very likely been complicit in gold smuggling for years. Thus, the Wagner group is siding with the party they think is most likely to be able to continue to secure these interests, particularly in opposition to any civilian-led government.
The Wagner group's history in Sudan dates back to the previous government of Omar al-Bashir. Wagner's leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, had a close relationship with former autocratic leader al-Bashir. After al-Bashir relinquished power due to a popular uprising, Wagner continued to have a close relationship with the Sudanese military, particularly the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces headed by Hemeti. It's a pattern analysts have seen before.
The Wagner group does seem to engage with African countries on a pretty predictable sort of pattern. Normally, it starts with the cultivation of elites, or at least a subset of elites, and then that is followed up with a formal military technical agreement between the states. And this could be something like, you know, Russia will supply arms in exchange for concessions that allow them to do mining or other kinds of resource extraction.
Since the fighting began in April, there have been unconfirmed reports saying that the Wagner fighters are supporting the RSF and supplying them with weapons and armor. Russia sees Sudan as a strategic location with vast mineral wealth and are eager to help install a friendly leader, say analysts.
We've seen a lot in recent months about Russia's efforts to gain a port on the Red Sea in Sudan through an official military relationship. And they've signed other official military relationships with other countries in the region.
Wagner's involvement in other parts of the continent like Libya, the Central African Republic, and Mali has in many cases been problematic, says Ben Dalton of New America, a Washington-based think tank.
They've been associated with widespread atrocities. Everywhere they go, you see, you know, civilian deaths and various atrocities. And, you know, Russia's interests are in extracting the continent's resources so that it can strengthen its own position and build a web to resist sort of international sanctions. They don't really have the interests of Africans at heart.
And as the conflict rages, civilians continue to pay the price. Salem Solomon, VOA News.
Former Vice President Mike Pence appeared before a Washington, D.C. grand jury investigating the deadly U.S. Capitol insurrection. Thursday's appearance by Pence came hours after a federal court denied a bid by former President Donald Trump's lawyers to block Pence's testimony. Associated Press correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
An inside source tells the Associated Press the former vice president did testify before the grand jury investigating efforts by former President Trump and his allies to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Mike Pence may provide prosecutors with a first-person account about certain conversations and actions in the weeks leading up to the deadly attack on the Capitol in 2021, which included calls for hanging Pence as a traitor. Pence was supposed to testify earlier this year, but Donald Trump's lawyers had objected, citing executive privilege. But a federal appeals court ruled he could. In his memoir, Pence outlines Trump's pressure campaign, urging him to reject Joe Biden's election victory. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan inaugurated a nuclear power plant via video Thursday in his first public appearance since falling ill on live TV and canceling campaign stops, as he sought to dispel concerns about his health weeks before a crucial election. Meanwhile, Erdogan's rival in next month's election has confronted a political taboo in Turkey by talking about a member of the Alevi Islamic group. Over the centuries, the progressive group has been the target of discrimination and violence. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
İlk oyunu verecek olan sevgili evlatlarım.
On YouTube, presidential candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, addressing first-time voters, declares his Alevi religious identity. Such admissions are rare in Turkish politics, as Alevism has suffered centuries of prejudice and discrimination from the majority Sunni Muslims. İşte Gözaydın is an expert on Turkish religion and state relations.
It's a different interpretation of Islam than the Sunni understanding. The rituals are different, the interpretation is different, the philosophy is different. So the hardcore Sunni ones do perceive it as a heretical interpretation.
Alevis pray in cemevis rather than mosques, worshipping through dance. Unlike most interpretations of Islam, there is no separation of men and women in prayer, and women aren't obliged to wear religious headscarves. Alevis repeatedly have been victims of sectarian violence. In 1993, a religious mob burned down a hotel hosting an Alevi cultural festival, killing 37. The violence continues to this day. Selami Sarıtaş, head of Istanbul's Kartal Cemevi, was attacked last year by a sectarian mob. He welcomes Kılıçdaroğlu's video.
Tabii ki bizim toplumumuzda da çok bir rahatlama oldu.
He says this video has brought a lot of relief to our society. At least now it has come to the point people can talk more openly about their Alevi identity. We want our children to live in a country in safety. We want our children to live in a country as equals. But Kılıçdaroğlu has been attacked and threatened on social media, accused of dividing the country. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan often makes thinly disguised attacks on Kılıçdaroğlu's Alevi identity. Until now, Kılıçdaroğlu's religious identity was widely considered an electoral handicap among many voters. However, as he heads an alliance of religious and nationalist parties, some observers say Turkish society is changing. Osman Sert, director of Panorama TR Research Company.
It was very important in the country, but nowadays, if you look at the Millet İttifak, the opposition's alliance, you know, the Islamists and the nationalists and the secularists and Alawites and the Sunnis are all together. And it means that it is not too much important as it was maybe 10 years ago.
Kılıçdaroğlu's video is seen as a political gamble. But with more than 100 million hits, it has had an impact. In an increasingly close election, it remains unclear whether Kılıçdaroğlu's gamble will pay off. But win or lose, some observers say he has already changed the country's political landscape. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Following these other stories from around the world, Iran's Navy seized a Marshall Islands flagged oil tanker in the Gulf of Oman on Thursday amid wider tensions over Tehran's nuclear program. The seizure represents the latest such capture in a waterway crucial for global energy supplies. A migration crisis is brewing at the border between Chile and Peru. It's intensifying as hundreds of people remain stranded. The mostly Venezuelan migrants are seeking to cross into Peru to continue to their home country, but aren't being allowed to enter Peru because they lack documents. And Ukraine's prime minister has asked Pope Francis to help bring back Ukrainian children who were forcibly taken to Russia. The International Criminal Court last month issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin and Russia's Children's Commissioner, accusing them of abducting children from Ukraine. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's nearly 46-year-old Voyager 2 and its twin, Voyager 1, are now traveling through interstellar space. Voyager 2's five science instruments continue to operate and send valuable data back to Earth. But NASA scientists realized that due to a dwindling power supply, they would have to shut off one of those instruments this year to keep the mission going. After careful evaluation, they decided instead to shut down Voyager 2's voltage regulator, which protects the science instruments from harmful voltage fluctuations. NASA says the decision was easier to make since electrical systems on both Voyager spacecraft have remained stable throughout their missions. If this power strategy works with Voyager 2, NASA may apply it to Voyager 1 next year when a similar decision must be made. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
V VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. A government-commissioned report on Thursday called for a thorough overhaul of Australia's immigration system. According to the Migration Review, the system is outdated and doesn't meet the country's current or future skills needs, and therefore requires a long-term and holistic approach to finding a solution. We hear more now from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
The report makes sweeping recommendations that will be considered by Australia's left-leaning Labor government. Home Affairs Minister Claire O'Neill, who commissioned the review, said Thursday that Australia has to skill up or sink. She said critical labour shortages are forcing Australia to be more assertive in the global race for talent, to recruit highly skilled overseas professionals and do more to retain the brightest international students. The government considers the complicated and outdated migration system to be a barrier to prosperity. It wants the country to be less reliant on temporary workers who would, if the report's recommendations are accepted, be given more opportunities to stay permanently. The government is promising safeguards to guard against exploitation and underpayment. The leader of the Conservative opposition, Susan Lee, responding to the report, told local media Thursday the government must address depopulation and the lack of health services in rural Australia, as well as improving housing and other essential services. O'Neill told the National Press Club in Canberra Thursday that major reform to immigration is desperately needed.
I've spoken a lot about what's going wrong with Australia's migration system today, and there are many, many problems. But what I am genuinely much more excited about is the big opportunity. We have every reason to be optimistic about our country's future, and every reason to believe that our migration system can help us deliver a more secure and prosperous Australia, as it has done for us so many times in the past.
The immigration review was carried out by Martin Parkinson, a former secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. His report said it was important that Australians don't feel threatened by economic migrants. Immigration has been the dominant theme in the story of modern Australia, which was colonised by the British in 1788. Although more than a quarter of Australia's population was born elsewhere, some Australians display hostility toward or fear of immigrants. Voters have supported hardline policies that sent asylum seekers arriving by boat without authorisation to offshore camps in the South Pacific. Since 2013, the Australian Navy has been towing or turning away migrant boats trying to reach Australian waters under the government's Operation Sovereign Borders, which continues under the current left-leaning Labor government. Australia's unemployment rate is 3.5%. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Well, remember when the world seemed to shut down and the global pandemic took hold? Many businesses turned into ghost towns, and some have never recovered. It was especially, of course, true for the hospitality industry. And I recently spoke with Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard about the hard-hit entertainment industry and asked if folks are starting to venture out again to see movies in person instead of at home. Have people started to go back?
Well, I tell you, I tell people all the time, in March of 2020, when we shut down for the pandemic, I just celebrated my 28th year as a film critic, as a broadcast journalist. I've been doing it 28 years as of January of this year. And I told people when the pandemic hit, I didn't lose my job, I lost my career. Literally, overnight, movies shut down, music shut down, sporting events shut down. We were all in lockdown. So I woke up the next day after our lockdown, nothing to do. There was nothing to do whatsoever. I've never felt so lost. During that time of our lockdown, the streaming services came out of nowhere. Even studios and media conglomerates who didn't have one saw the opportunity because they thought the captured audience was all at home. You know, so here we are 2 years later after the pandemic, after the shutdown, and, you know, people still want that experience at home. So the box office hasn't returned yet. In 2019, they did $15 billion. And at the end of 2022, they did $7 billion. So no, absolutely not. It has not come back yet. And when people go to the movies, right now, what's driving the box office is family films and younger moviegoers like horror films like Scream 6, or look at Super Mario Brothers. Unbelievable. $436 million domestically, $439 million million internationally. It's at 875 million just after a few weeks. I mean, so that's who's going to the movies, is children, family, and, you know, the younger people. The older people are staying at home and watching Netflix, Disney Plus, and all of those.
What you're saying is that only very specific genres, like families that want to get their kids out, very specific group of people are going to the movies, but nothing like it used to be, and it's a whole different animal now?
Well, people are going to the movies that are seeing what they call tentpole movies. You know, Steven Spielberg was quoted last year at the Academy Awards luncheon for all the nominees to Tom Cruise. He said, "You saved the industry. You saved movies as we know it," because Top Gun saw that people would go back to the theater there was a tentpole, a big budget spectacle movie. This summer we have Fast 10, the new Fast and Furious, the Little Mermaid adaptation, the new Indiana Jones, a new Transformers, Rise of the Beast, the new Mission Impossible with Tom Cruise. Those will do fantastic and drive people back to the theater. But the art films, the independent films, the smaller films, nobody's seeing them. They're finding their way to streaming.
Are movie theaters the way of 8-track tapes?
Oh, absolutely not. It's always going to be an experience. It's always going to be a night out. And I think it will still exist, but it'll be in a different form, a lot smaller form. We'll see about how these theater chains come out of bankruptcy and see how that works. This summer will be a big telltale barometer of the theater industry and where we're going with all these new big tentpole movies coming out. So let's have this conversation again around Labor Day when the summer season movie ends, and we'll find out how theaters and their health are. It should be interesting.
Jeffrey K. Howard, Vegas film critic. It is always great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me anytime.
And you can find Jeff at VegasFilmCritic.com. You've been listening to International Edition on Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook, we thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have yourselves a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since Burma's military coup 2 years ago and the regime's ensuing crackdown on opposition to its rule, the people of Burma have suffered greatly. Over 3,000 killed, nearly 17,000 detained, and more than 1.3 million displaced. But even in the face of this evidence of the regime's brutality, the airstrikes leveled against a village in the Sagaing region on April 11th stand out in their ruthlessness and cruelty. While hundreds of people, including women and children, assembled to celebrate the opening of a building put up by a pro-democracy group, the regime reportedly dropped multiple bombs on the villagers. Then a helicopter strafed the area as people tried to flee. Although the official toll remains unclear, estimates are that more than 100 people were killed, many of them children. Observers note that the regime is stepping up its use of airstrikes against the civilian population, with devastating results. In October, for example, some 80 people were reportedly killed in an airstrike in northern Burma. On April 10th, the day before the attack in Sagaing, airstrikes in Chin State reportedly killed at least 9. The international community has reacted with shock and condemnation. U.S. State Department Principal Deputy Spokesperson Vidant Patel said in a statement, "These violent attacks further underscore the regime's disregard for human life and its responsibility for the dire political and humanitarian crisis in Burma following the February 2021 coup." UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk said he was horrified by the attack, noting it appears school children performing dances, as well as other civilians, were among the victims. Nabila Masrali, EU spokesman for foreign affairs and security policy, said the EU is deeply shocked by reports of the latest atrocity committed by the military regime in Sagaing, taking the lives of dozens of innocent civilians. ASEAN strongly condemned the airstrikes. U.S. Principal Deputy Spokesperson Patel said, "The United States calls on the Burma regime to cease the horrific violence, allow unhindered humanitarian access, and to respect the genuine and inclusive democratic aspirations of the people of Burma. the military regime must abide by its obligations under international humanitarian law, including rules on the protection of civilians. The United States will continue to work with the international community to hold the regime accountable for violations and abuses committed in Burma.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.